It is the final countdown, as Europe once said, as the seconds particularly begin to count down until the PPI deadline actually strikes. Yes, that pause for dramatic effect there can only mean that we have to bring in the two awesome folk who are indeed TV presenter extraordinaire, the fabulous Alison Habband. How are you, Alison?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. I'm good.
Excellent. And the equally fabulous PPI deadline campaign lead from the FCA, that's the wonderful Emma Stranick. How are you, Emma?
Very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. Now,
we're like the dream team, so you know.
Clearly, right. Exactly. I mean,
we're getting people's money back. That's what we're doing.
You are superheroes, Alison, clearly on that basis. Now, for those people who are listening to this, literally there are hours to go now, because until 23.59 hours, that of course is 24-hour clock, so literally 1 minute to midnight on Thursday 29th of August. That's all you've got to actually claim back the PPI. What are you going to say, Emma, to people who say, it's too late now, I can't do it, it's no good?
It's not too late. You're right, 1 minute to midnight tomorrow is the deadline, but you've got all day today. My strong advice is to go to our website, fca.org.uk/PPI, and all you need is on the website. You've got a long list of PPI providers, and you can complain yourself directly for free. Just go onto the website and have a look.
Now, Alison, I cannot believe when I saw that you were on the third series of Big Brother, 17 years ago. Alison,
yes.
Lord above, I mean, even the series has gone since then, but at least, Alison Habband, you're there and with us from that point of view. What are your thoughts on this? Because, I mean, look at some of the research. A third of people are going to leave their decision about whether to claim until the last 24 hours. I mean, is it like Brexit negotiations? What's going on here?
It's just the way we are. We're a nation of leaving things to the last minute. Just so people know, you can still get your PPI. And I just think it would be such a shame if you got to after tomorrow and you haven't claim that money. So many people had store cards back in the day. You just said, you know, it's been 2003. I can remember having store cards, catalogue credit, mortgage. Do you know what I mean? People had finance on their cars, home loan improvements on their homes and mortgages and things like that. It'd be just such a shame if they were missold PPI. I mean, some people didn't even know it was added. You know what I mean? They didn't even know that they were paying for it. So, I mean, some people might have been pressured into it. But ultimately, if they don't get that money back, that would be such a shame. My brother just recently got £7,000 back, and he was, like, literally over the moon. Such a lovely touch for him to have his money back. And it's not free money. This is your money that you've paid, and you're entitled to have it back. So don't let this money go to waste. There's so many agencies out there who are claiming 20%. You don't need to do it. You can do it on your own. Go to the website, and it literally holds your hand and helps you through the whole process. There's a comprehensive list of providers, so you can look at that list and think, oh, did I have a car finance with them? Yeah, I did. Oh, and I had a store card with them. So it kind of jogs your memory. So just go online. It's dead easy. Don't see it as a big stress. Just go online and do it. That's what I would say. And get your money back.
Well, Emma, I'm sure you'll echo what Alison's been saying there. I mean, particularly interesting in terms of store cards with high street stores, catalogue firms, building societies, supermarkets. I mean, I suppose ultimately you could say, well, make the sacrifice, say, what the hey, I wanted to make a charitable donation to the company itself, because that's what capitalism is all about. But ultimately, you would presumably take Alison's line there, Emma, that it's worth doing, just working through that, even though there are literally just hours to go now.
Absolutely. It's relatively simple to do. All you need is your name, date of birth, and your current address, any addresses you might have had credit products with. As Alison was saying, it was sold back in the 90s and noughties, so you'd think about addresses for then. And that's all you need to get going. So I would encourage people to do that. 5.4 million people have already visited our website. Add to those numbers and make sure that you make a decision once and for all.
Certainly, if we're looking at the number crunching, £340.4 million paid to customers just in June 2019 about the whole system, and the total amount since January 2011, £36 billion. Honestly, you could actually sort of have a trip to Mars and back for that basis, maybe a few times. But finally, can we just share with the listener, Emma, the best place to go to? Once again, you mentioned it once or twice, but the best place online to go to sort this thing out in the literally the seconds that remain?
In the seconds that remain, search FCA PPI for all you need before the deadline.
And two final questions for your customer satisfaction ones, because we don't charge PPI, obviously. Emma Stranach and Alison Hammond, have you both had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
It's been amazing.
It's been fabulous, Alex.
So can we prevail upon you post-PPI to keep the team together, keep the dream team of Alison and Emma together? Will you be kind enough to return?
That would be my
privilege. What can we do next?
Well, there is a thing that's taking place in Parliament, or an extension of Parliament, that I think we probably need to address, really, in terms of that, and sort out things with Europe, and then there's America with Donald Trump. Listen, there's a lot of
We're
things that need to be
it.
Done. Exactly.
We are all over it.
DJ Fresh featuring Rita Ora. I wonder if he ever considered himself as DJ Stale or DJ past his sell-by date. I don't know. Maybe Gabriella Peralta could be able to answer that question. DJ Fresh, Gabriella?
I have heard of him.
Yeah, but not quite sort of, you know, really fresh, etc. Gabriella is in Gibraltar. She's got the weather forecast for Lincoln all set and ready to go after the news from the Sky News Centre. We've got Richard Fitzwilliams on Never Look Away and Transit, and probably some of the things that have been happening in Westminster, probably. Ian Lennox is going to be joining us as ever, and we've also got former SAS MI5 and MI6 hostage negotiator on The Art of Good Conversation. Employment liability lawyer Peter Lyons will be talking about how the mental health of workers in Britain is pretty close to breaking point.
FM.
And now the news.
Online. Mobile. This is Siren Radio. Lincoln. Siren Radio.
So that's all good then. It's the 29th of August 2019, the last Thursday midweek drive morning edition of 2019, August the month of... So, Gabriella, we come to you to keep the standard flying high with, of course, that classic line, the weather for Lincoln, England, from Gabriella in Gibraltar.
Okay, so the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 21 degrees centigrade, lows of 13 degrees centigrade, and it's a fresh, breezy day with sunny intervals.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Given the political situation, I figured that it's time to actually wheel out the big guns. So this morning, Gabrielle, I decided to actually go to Instagram and access the account of Lord Frodo the Pug, in which you can follow Frodo on a journey where there will always be a second breakfast. And I had not been aware he even actually has a YouTube channel as well.
Oh, yeah, I have only ever posted one video of him.
Yeah, but it's enough, really. I mean, you know, you don't want him to get sort of media heavy with respect to overexposure. I mean, you know, there's sort of always the tendency that you could sort of go all over the place with Lord Frodo. And looking at some of the photographs, which I would normally have had one of the Midweek Drivers actually describe, but they're not here, so I'm going to have to do it in their absence. We've even got him in a basket with various toys, which I thought initially were Star Wars toys, figurines and so on. It seems that we've got that. I mean, are those his friends?
Yeah, he likes to be with all his toys.
He likes to be so he's very, very keen on that basis. I think the one which will probably get the maximum amount of cuteness would certainly be the one with his little red overcoat and little eyes looking up on that basis. So that's definitely a winner from that point of view. But I mean, you know, these days, as we know, effectively he no longer lives with you. He lives with the parents. Fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, is he still okay? Does he still remember you? Is it a case of does he remember his agent and so on?
Yeah, I'm seeing him tonight. I'm seeing my parents, and I'll see Frodo. But yeah, Frodo's good. He's had an operation to widen his nostrils, so I call it a nose job.
Yes.
So he breathes a bit better, or quite a lot better. He doesn't snore anymore, which is really, like, and snort really. So he's doing really well.
Well, that's all we needed to know, because I was conscious that we hadn't actually sort of spoken of the aforementioned Frodo, even though it's regularly mentioned in the jingle and I don't, and so on. Let's briefly talk to the art of conversation with, as I say, a former SAS MI5 and MI6 hostage negotiator. It seems that British folk, according to this particular survey, are not good at holding a conversation. Indeed, there's a whole sort of line of things in which people are willing to suffer a dull conversation for as long as 5 minutes before extricating ourselves from the situation. We become more impatient with age, meaning that you've got to have more luck talking to 16 to 23-year-olds who can keep an uninteresting conversation alive for almost 6 minutes. However, if you get over 74, you probably only get 4 minutes before they just say, talk to the hand because the face ain't listening, or words to that effect. Is that the same thing in Gibraltar? Or is it just a case of, well, what do you expect when we've got the leaders in Parliament that we have? They just switch off.
Gibraltar is quite friendly. But I think it also depends on different parts of the UK, because I feel like you probably have less luck.
Well,
maybe down south in London than you would up north. I've always heard that they're more chatty.
Well, apparently, the key things are to steer clear from no-go topics of religion, Donald Trump and Brexit if you want to keep things running smoothly. And stick to the tried and tested topics such as mutual interests, Lord Frodo the Pug, maybe, happy stories, Lord Frodo the Pug, Instagram, etc., and nostalgic memories. Do you remember nostalgia? Didn't used to be what it was, or isn't what it used to be, etc. And that basically avoids people zoning out. Like, one in three British people who actually zone out. Anyway, moving on from that particular perspective, etc. What you do for the rest of the day, Gabriella? You'd zoned out, had you? Admit it. You know, there I am, working my backside after trying it today. You just tuned out. I don't know. 7 minutes past 8 o'clock, Thursday morning. Suddenly it's, whoa, where's it gone? I don't know.
What am I doing?
I
don't actually have anything planned today. I just have to put things in the paper.
Well, that's fine then.
That's my job every day. So that's my job today. I'll get some blank pages.
Yes.
And then
you put stuff on them.
I'll put stuff on them.
Squiggly bits of ink will actually be sort of printed on the whole thing, and then human beings, being what they are, will probably decode those squiggly bits of paper, bits of things, and actually make some kind of coherent sense that they might like to use in the art of conversation.
Exactly.
It's genius. Yeah. You see, who was it who ever considered education a sadly lacking resource in the 21st century? Not us, in any way, shape, or form. Gabriella, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I have, thank you.
And will you be back with us maybe next week, although we may well actually be on a pre-record next week, because we'll be out and about in the joys of the Burley Horse Trials, possibly, or indeed in Great Yarmouth. Yeah, I know, very strange. One of those two. Will you be back with us, if not next week, then the week after?
I will be back whenever you're free.
Oh, it's genius.
Yeah.
French MEP and former Europe Minister Nathalie Loiseau described the recent activities in Westminster as a sign that there was a disease in British democracy. We could see a Brexit without an agreement. It is, moreover, a Brexit without debate that is looming. From what disease is British democracy suffering from that there is a fear of debate before taking one of the most important decisions in its history? A disease, Richard.
Well, I can only say that, firstly, this, it's not unprecedented, but Brexit is unprecedented, so it is obviously done to make debate and also make any anti-Brexit coalition, making it much more difficult. But what we're talking about is actually terribly serious, because if you have an unwritten constitution, if matters tend to proceed by a general form of agreed precedent, and if you do this and behave in this way by suspending Parliament, obviously with the purpose of making it more difficult for your opponents. I mean, the precedents about this, for example, in 1948, where Attlee was dealing with the reform of the House of Lords and so on, or 1997, John Major. I mean, there was an election called in a few days. I mean, this, they are not, in my view, comparable. What you've had, of course, is the Queen being forced. She has no choice. She's head of state. She acts on the advice of her ministers. When requested to give assent to this, she did. And it would have been unthinkable had she not
she
done so.
She could have used the royal prerogative. She could have used the royal prerogative. That's all that's saying.
Well, hey. You could make one point. I merely offer this up to the show. I haven't seen this anywhere else. But if, for example, it had been speculated that for some reason Parliament might, it was just a thought I saw written somewhere or other, that Parliament could be being prorogued until after the 31st of October. Now, if that had happened, literally making debate impossible, this is the reason, but you have the monarch as a sort of democratic long stop. If something absolutely terrifying like that had happened, because that would have made a debate absolutely, well, it would have been, I think that would have plunged us into waters that are even deeper than we are now. But the point with this is also what it is going to lead to. It's clearly, in my opinion, Boris Johnson's been advised by Dominic Cummings, who's the Australian fixer, who was in charge of planning for, as we saw in the BBC documentary.
Is he Australian? I thought he was more Durham and Tyneside-based, actually.
Oh, I must then withdraw that. I thought he was, for some reason.
That's right.
No, well, perhaps he isn't, but the point at the heart of this is that it is considered by opponents and also, I think, by a very great number of people on the Conservative side as being something absolutely outrageous. I mean, it will speed the disintegration of the Union, what we're having today and actually what we're awaiting today.
Well, we can look forward to England, the monarchy of England, ruled by Emperor Boris and his Empress Queen Carrie, who will obviously sort of look after
it
us.
Is
coming in full force. And then the Windsor occupants can actually move overseas to some sort of base and maybe look after Scotland.
It is quite weird because you have an unelected Prime Minister, which he hasn't been, doing this in circumstances where we are approaching the 31st of October, which is when supposedly, unless there's an extension, you can rule nothing out that we leave the EU. What has to be mentioned is, firstly, we don't know what procedural matters may occur to possibly change this. I mean, it appears from what I was hearing yesterday that it would be difficult to change in the courts, but it is certainly possible. We know the Speaker's outraged. We also know that there is one of the problems has been that for the 3 years since the referendum, as we know, Parliament has wrestled with its decision. But the fact of the matter, if you do this, if you start tinkering with the Constitution, if you haven't yourself been elected, for example, if you haven't even got a majority, if you're in a form of coalition...
But that's never stopped dictators of banana republics in the past, Sir Richard. I mean, they're just sort of, you know, it's. I mean, surely, you know, we can actually move it up a couple of notches and actually have martial law declared, because, you know... Anyway, listen, let's step away from that.
I was absolutely shocked, I have to say, because it seemed to me... That, I mean, even at the level of realpolitik, it seemed to me that the opponents of Johnson were having a great deal of trouble in the problem being not that they all agreed that they didn't want a no-deal Brexit, but how on who or what would replace the current government, if anything. And this still remains a great problem. This is, it's an absolutely huge gamble, because you could either have the union splitting, you could have the Conservative Party disintegrating. It is impossible to know for what. I mean, once you start breaking convention on a matter like this, and it's not a question. One of the odd things is that Jacob Rees-Mogg is something of a constitutional expert, and to try and pretend there's nothing special happening is absolutely outrageous.
Just because you're an expert doesn't necessarily mean that you're a nice person. But anyway,
I don't think anyone would quibble with that, but it, what is bizarre is that if you outrage people in to this extent, I mean, talk about divisive measures, what I think will give the Queen cause for concern, though we'll never know, is firstly, she values the union tremendously. Secondly, she would obviously prefer that things are less divisive as a symbol of national unity. But thirdly, it would be impossible, other than under circumstances such as those I had described. Queen Anne's was the last in 1708 on Bill and the Scottish Militia. In 1834, King William dismissed a government which had majority support. It was Lord Melbourne's, Queen Victoria's great favourite. The facts simply are that we are not only in uncharted waters, but things are going to get very, very nasty and very difficult, because this is seen, if you look at Hugh Grant's tweet, for example, I can't read it all out on air, it's certainly an indication of the way a lot of people feel about this.
Well, we'll leave it this particular moment with two little lines. First of all, from Katie Balls, of course, the deputy political editor of The Spectator. During the EU referendum campaign, Vote Leave campaign director Dominic Cummings operated on the principle, with a pirate and a half. With a gentleman and a half. The idea being that whoever you deal with, it's a good idea to think as they do, but better. And from the other side, perhaps Guy Verhofstadt, former Belgian Prime Minister, taking back control, to use the strapline, of course, from the thing that kicked it off 3 years ago, has never looked so sinister. As a fellow parliamentarian, my solidarity is with those fighting for their voices to be heard. Anyway, moving on, Richard, as we have to do, I thought you'd given up on the coming-of-age movies, but no, you've exhausted Hollywood. You've now gone to a German coming-of-age romantic drama with Never Look Away.
This is the first time ever, and this was a pure accident that it happened, but to have two German films and discuss both of them on the same broadcast, I mean, it has not happened. And I'm only sorry that we don't get more German films. We don't. We get very few, and obviously The Lives of Others and Downfall are the likes.
And Lola Rent, Run Lola Run, that was wonderful, from Tim Tickfer back in 1997.
Yeah, that is quite a long time ago, going back over 20 years. And I mean, the thing is, this, Never Look Away, is by Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, who made his name with Downfall. We'll forget The Tourist, I didn't say that. In fact, it's over 3 hours. Now, this is a film that's based on the life of Gerhard Richter, the famous artist. In fact, the film itself doesn't specifically mention either his name or this fact, but Richter, in fact, cooperated, but it was too emotional for him to see the film. This was an Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Language Film, and also nominated in the cinematography category. It's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it is. I have to say that I was really blown away by it. At the beginning, we see Hitler's exhibition of what was called degenerate art, a small child, Kurt Barnett, inspired by the artist Gerard Richter, this character, visits the exhibition of degenerate art with his beautiful and unusual, rather eccentric aunt Elizabeth, played by Saskia Rosenthal. She is eccentric. She plays the piano in the nude, for example, and so on, and she's suspected of being schizophrenic. The doctor who orders her forced sterilization and sends her to her death is the gynecology professor Carl Siebert, this is played by Sebastian Koch, of the SS Medical Corps, led by Dr. Kroll, played by Rainer Bock. After the war, Siebert's arrested by the Russians and imprisoned, but when he volunteers to help a Russian officer's wife in childbirth and saves the child, the Russian officer protects him. Kurt subsequently, as he grows up, studies painting at Dresden, where he falls in love with Ellie, played by Paula Beer, and she has a resemblance to his sister. What he doesn't know is that her father is the murderer of his sister. This is a dramatic and powerful film. Firstly, Kurt being an artist, he's a painter of socialist realism, murals of the people's struggle, the last thing he wants, and also Carl Siebert, the former Nazi, is now a prominent East German ideologue. He dislikes Kurt, who's going out with his daughter, even sabotages her womb whilst performing an abortion. But nonetheless, he can't stop them marrying. And when his Russian protector leaves, he goes to the West. Kurt also flees the East Germany for the West. This is just before the war. Goes to Dusseldorf Art Academy, where figurative painting is hopelessly outdated. The way this plays out is absolutely extraordinary. It is a coming-of-age film, but that phrase is, you know, we've discussed so many, and very often they're American comedies, and very often they're films that are light-hearted or amusing or give an insight into what it's like in, generally normal surroundings, which have unusual aspects to them. But here you've got the move. You had Nazi Germany, then you have communist East, and then you have what's happening in the West, where, for example, it's perfectly possible to be an art student, and all you've got to do is splash paint on the wall. He doesn't want any realism. And what indeed happens to his father-in-law when the SS officer who he worked for is actually uncovered as a war criminal. What indeed? It will rivet you. I can only say that the performances are just absolutely superb, and I've got to mention most particularly gynecologist Sebastian Koch is absolutely amazing. But the whole thing, all of it, superbly and also fascinatingly ambiguous.
But Richard, how, at the end of the day, does it compare with what The Guardian has described as a brilliant existential thriller which works like a dream, Christian Petzold's Transit?
I was just...
I know, we were looking away
yes,
from...
Yes, I must move, yes. I would say that both are remarkable films. I would praise the former, but perhaps slightly more, but Transit is extraordinary, and it's also, it's German, it's directed by Christian Petzold, it's based on 1942 novel, and we meet Georg, played by Franz Rajowski, at the last minute. He flees Paris, this is Paris with the Germans in situ, and also they haven't reached Marseille which he reaches, but one of the things in this film, you don't actually see the Germans. The fascist regime is already there, though, in the form of the French police, who are rounding people up and shooting them and behaving very much as the Germans did behave before they arrive. So the city of Marseille, you go there because Marseille is a place where you have transit and arrange transit abroad. He has documents in the name of the writer, Weidel, who's committed suicide. And Weidel is guaranteed by the Mexican consulate to have passage, and he takes Weidel's identity. So we meet all these refugees congregating in bars and consulates and so forth. And when he reaches Marseille, Heinz, his late comrade, who dies in the train, he also has the address of Heinz's wife. So he's masquerading as Vidal. He reaches Heinz's wife, who's deaf and dumb, and his makeup friends, his son, Driss, played by Lillian Bettman very well, I have to say. It also, this is a curious aspect of this film, it's a slightly unsatisfactory thing about it, because Marie Vidal, who is, of course, the wife, the widow, but she doesn't know it, of her husband, played by Paul Abir. Well, she knows her husband's around because, of course, he's masquerading as her, but, of course, she doesn't know that. And he starts getting enthralled to this rather extraordinary woman. He starts being haunted by her, and this is a question of her believing her husband's there, but the person who's imitating him is, of course, or masquerading as him, is, of course, not her husband, is dead. When Driss falls ill, he goes to see a doctor, Richard, played by Goethals Giesa, but doesn't realize Murray is his mistress. They're hoping to file letters of transit and get out, but this is drawn into a very surreal world. The parallels to the migration perils of today and the way migrants are treated, humans, so to speak, tossed around like confetti. Also, the regime, the French police, I mean, they appear in monstrous form constantly. It is a city stalked by fear before the invaders have actually got there. And also, it's rather mysterious. What precisely does Vidal's wife, Elizabeth, see in him, and what does he see in her, and what happens? This is a fascinating film. I mean, again, it's an audacious movie, and the way it's filmed, and the way it is set in wartime, as I say, it's completely novel, but it will punch you at the end. That's all I'm saying.
Zwei deutsche Filmen.
I know, it is amazing, and may never happen again, I have to say.
Unglaublich. Still, never mind. We shall carry on. Richard, we've got literally just seconds to mention Night of the Iguana. I know we've squeezed this around so many times. Do you want to say a few words about the stage version?
I guess I would, because I do think it's a fascinating play. It's always tricky, you know, when a play is it's almost haunted by the film, which I would say was perfection, directed by John Huston in 1964, with Richard Burton as the defrocked priest Shannon, who's leading a party of ladies in any job he can get, which is taking a tour around parts of Mexico, and arrives at the hotel of Maxine Falk, played by here by Anna Gunn, where he is also he's a masquerading Shannon is irredeemably attracted to young girls, and there's a Lolita-like figure, and there's also, in the sense of Miss Fellows.
I thought we weren't going to mention Prince Andrew. Let's step away from that.
Well, there you have it. You see, it just came in. I was wondering how to bring it in. And some of the eccentric characters here, including poet Jonathan Coffin, played by wonderful Julian Glover. You can hear everything he says. And also Leah Williams as Hannah Jelks, who travels with her nonagenarian grandfather from hotel to hotel and is penniless. But what you have here is an extraordinary clash of characters, cultures, and also personalities. I have to praise Clive Owen, because I think his many fans will see that he has real depth here. I have to make a confession, though. I'm tremendously an admirer of Leah Williams, because she was superb as the prime of Miss Jean Brodie, and also at Mary Stuart, where she played Mary opposite Juliet Stevenson when I saw the play. I do have to say that she puts on an accent as Hannah, which is, I found, very difficult to hear, which did affect my enjoyment of the play a bit. But the set, I mean, it drips heat, and when it was actually hot in London.
You need air conditioning, clearly, air conditioning, otherwise those iguanas will get all over the place.
Well, the iguanas, I mean, it is a... Tennessee Williams has this remarkable ability. The film is set at the time London was being burnt. There's some comic Germans. They were always have fun with choosing extras to play these gargoyles, wandering around chanting that London was under attack. And it's an autobiographical play, but my goodness me. Burton's performance as Shannon, it was amazing. I saw Woody Harrelson in the role. I think he thought he actually was God. Clive Owen is very good indeed, and also his voice projection superb. And I thought it was an extremely enjoyable, slightly flawed, night at the theatre.
Often thought Clive Owen would have made an excellent James Bond, but that's another line entirely still.
Well, it's an interesting thought, it is.
Okay, Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yes, I have indeed.
Phil Lerner sends his best, but hasn't quite worked himself up to doing two shows, the Wednesday night and the Thursday morning as yet. But he's
How is he? How are his eyes?
Seems to be very good, that's all.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
Exactly. So he can actually see the insanity that's taking place in the White House and in 10 Downing Street this week. So it's all wonderful.
Dear me. It's going to get very difficult, because also when you tamper with an unwritten constitution, who knows, alternative parliaments, attempts to take over government business, leaders of the opposition wanting to see the Queen. I mean, once you start this, there won't be an end easily to it.
And that's one of the reasons why we'll be talking with employment liability lawyer Peter Lyons, who has actually sort of come up with a survey that suggests that 25%, that's a quarter, of United Kingdom workers' mental health is at breaking point. Just relax, keep breathing, and remember, you could always listen to the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Edition via podcast if you don't catch us live. That's very important. Richard, will you return?
I will indeed.
Conversations that families share at dinner time and so on. Is it just a case of we're looking longingly at the past in a nostalgic manner, or is there actually a top 10 list of dinner time discussions which effectively impact on certain things we don't mention, including perhaps the B word? No, not at dinner, please. Well, best person to actually discuss this recent finding and survey is a gentleman who's got a million followers on Instagram. He is indeed father of daughters, FOD himself. It's Simon Hooper. How are you, Simon?
I'm very good. Thank you very much for having me on.
Excellent. Genuine delight, Simon. Now, this particular little feature that's come through, television not to be discussed at the dinner table, social media, I mean, that's going to give problems with respect to Instagram, surely. a religion, holidays, the economy, current affairs, money, video games, and politics, all in the list that effectively we don't really like to talk about. I mean, it doesn't leave a great deal, does it, really?
No, well, it's quite interesting to read. The research has just been done by McCain into the nation's conversations, which is basically talking about what we talk about behind closed doors. You're never privy to conversations in other people's family homes as to what they're talking about. So this was quite eye-opening to understand, you know, what people ban at the table, what people really talk about. So it was interesting reading.
It's quite fascinating to find that 92% of those surveyed, 3,000 surveyed by McCain, as you mentioned, cite dinner time as a key moment in their day. Is that true with yourself and your four daughters?
Yeah, well, if I think about it, our family is dispersed during the day. I'm at work and the kids are at school or at nursery. And so really, there's only about 60 to 90 minutes of the day when we're all together and we have an opportunity to talk. And dinner time is one of those moments. So it's a real valuable time, as long as I can get all the kids to the table without arguing, obviously.
whether we're talking about Project Yellowhammer, Project Black Swan, or any of the other panic nations, is it a case of, you know, the problem with the B word, the Brexit, and so on and so forth, is it does polarise people, and is that something you try to avoid? You don't want people to say, we should never have left, we should be leaving, we leave to need today, basically.
Well, I don't try and take things off the table. I want the conversation to be as open as possible as I can with my kids. So I know that there is a list that this report has produced of things that, you know, should either be banned or create problems at the table in terms of arguments. But actually, arguments are a good thing amongst family members because it helps you learn about someone's position on something. And yes, Brexit is divisive, but my daughters are 12, 8, and I have identical twins who are 3.5. So they don't have particularly strong feelings or opinions on Brexit yet. They do ask me rather challenging questions, though, which I kind of muddled my way through.
Why have you destroyed our future, Daddy? No, that's not going to line entirely. I was intrigued to find that on a different topic, of course, entirely, a 1 in 10 have discussed gender, sexual identity, or indeed sex at the dinner table. Now, there is a phrase I could go into there, but I won't say that at all in terms of dinner table and sex. It gets very messy. but in terms of the actual sequence, was that something which, again, you think, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's almost as though it's the classic embarrassing parental birds and bees conversation back in the day, really.
Exactly. But I think times are starting to move, and maybe I'm from a bit more of an interesting type of family, but my wife is a midwife as well. So anything that's medical or to do with the body is kind of open for discussion, and we try and not limit things. So we've had those discussions about diversity and inclusion and at the table, because you need to normalise those things with young children to make sure that they realise it's not a taboo subject and that it is okay to ask questions about things you don't understand.
So apart from criticising the medical efficacy of Call the Midwife, for instance, in the Hooper household, what sort of topics are genuinely discussed? I mean, can we actually just have a little fly on the window, so to speak, in terms of, let's say, this evening? I mean, will it be a case of you all gather around, et cetera, you think, right, today we're going to talk about existential psychoanalysis or some such?
I can guarantee that one won't be on the top of the list. Oh, but I'm really sorry.
Never mind.
But I think that the standards, the staples of just finding out how people's days are going is the most important thing. But I know for a fact we'll be talking about screen time, because surprisingly, one of the findings in the report is that 40% of parents now allow some kind of screen at the table, which I'm kind of blown away by, because the idea of that, I always thought the table was to be able to converse with people, look at them in the eye, understand how they're going. But apparently a lot of parents are just saying, you know what, it's okay, have a little bit of screen time to make this life a little bit easier.
That's interesting, because certainly it kind of moves from that notion of what I think used to be very popular a few years ago, having a kind of no mobile phone zone area, where effectively you would surrender the mobile phone for the duration of the eating period. Is that being eroded away as a case of, well, you know, it's a bit like reading the newspaper at the paper or at the table. You know, we might be irritated by it, but at the end of the day, let's just run with it.
Yeah, I think it might be an evolution of the times. Like, trying to get a screen out of a child's hand these days is, you know, requires some kind of vice or tool to be able to do it. So, you know, I think I've made my peace with it. I'm one of those people that if things are going bad in a restaurant, for example, I will get a screen out. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because it saves everyone else's dinner, that they might actually have a nice time, as opposed to listening to my kids scream.
So you're taking one for the team, so to speak, there. The altruism is knows no end.
Yes.
And intriguing in terms of, again, high in the list of things that shouldn't be discussed, of course, we talked about the M word, money. Is it kind of things that could create a kind of awkward silence or awkward embarrassment, or could conceivably polarise people? Are those best avoided, would you say, at times?
I think it depends on the nature of the conversation. With money, with my children, it tends to be about pocket money and how I massively underpay compared to the market, although I have no evidence to back that up whatsoever. It's just the hearsay of children who say I need to pay more. So it's just one of those things. But I don't think, as long as you're not talking about the state of your mortgage with your children, then I don't think that's necessarily going to be an issue. So.
Unless we're doomed, but still, never mind. That's another line entirely. And are there any sort of topics that you would say couldn't be discussed at mealtime? Or is there a way in which you can frame things, depending on the age, obviously, of the children, etc., that ultimately we can go into to most things at appropriate levels, or maybe even just open up the conversation, shall we say?
Yeah, I don't think anything should be off the table between family members. I think we should be able to talk openly and honestly. And it's the one opportunity, as I mentioned, that you can actually have everyone together and to be able to open up and talk. And invariably, if you have a conversation about something which is spiky, which generates opinion, then you are going to have differences. But those differences are actually the things that bring us together as a family in the first place. And I want my children to be able to air an opinion going forward. I might not necessarily agree with it, but at least they've got a forum to do it.
It's often stated that sometimes it's all about the location. Do you actually have your evening meal in a kitchen environment, or is it actually in a dining room? Is there a specific sort of part of the house where you say this is the dining area?
Yeah, we have an open plan kitchen dining room. So the kitchen table and the dining room table, that's where you eat. That's the most important thing. I don't want children wandering around the house. It's hard enough to get them to come and sit down in one place as it is. So.
I won't ask if you have butler or maid service, of course, because that's another issue entirely. But, a million followers. I think it's only a matter of time, certainly, before we reach November. No, maybe not. Can't get the servants. Simon, where can people go to find out further information about this McCain survey, which I'm sure could actually open up a whole new conversation itself?
Yeah, you can go to mccain.co.uk to go and find the report. And I think it's just interesting reading to find out what everyone else is talking about, because invariably we don't talk about it between ourselves when we're seeing friends or anything like that.
And clearly we need to mention Forever Outnumbered, a book which is out now, foreveroutnumbered.com. Presumably it's a case of the case of yourself battling against the female species, shall we say.
It's just an insight into how I've negotiated my way to get to this point. I think I'm still making it up as I go along, but aren't most parents?
Well, that makes perfect sense. And clearly we can follow you as well on Instagram and become the 1,000,001 person, presumably.
Yeah, please go for it.
Simon, many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you very much.
Four daughters. Four daughters. Ian Lennox, how would you have coped with four daughters in your household?
Well, I did cope with three.
Yeah, that's what I say. But would you have gone that extra? You know, that extra 3 + 1, you know, was that...
I had a son as well.
Oh, I see. Oh, right. Well, there we
go. It was 4 and 1.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. 4 and 2.
Well, welcome back to the programme, Ian. And the unanswered question, of course, has to be, now that Steve Dale's available and he's actually done and dusted with Bury, do you think he could possibly take over from Mike Ashley at the Toon?
We've got no troubles.
Well, you say that, but, I mean, Emma Street, she claims she's on holiday. We know the reason she's not here today. You know, Tottenham Hotspur 0, Steve Bruce's Giants with Mike Ashley's cash, of course. You one glorious goal, Joe Linton scores. You know, success on that basis. Ben Stokes goes and actually sort of saves the Ashes for a wee while at least.
Durham player, once a year.
Surely he should be the next Prime Minister. You know, we've got to get the campaign for Stokes to get to time Downing Street. It has to
start. I would be willing to bet the next time there's some sort of crisis in government, there'll be a move to get him made a knighthood, or given a knighthood or something.
That's like pretty much every day these days, isn't it, Ian? There's a crisis in government, but let's not go there. You know, we'll take the advice of Insta-dad Simon Hooper and say, let's just steer away from that for the moment. I mean, we've already kind of discussed it at length on the programme and so on. But were you pleased with Joe Linton getting off the mark? Even Alan Shearer looked to be delighted with, obviously, the new look. I mean, is it a case now it's Rafa who, you know, that sort of side that basically there's no doubting the fact that until they actually played Leicester, and I know Fergus isn't in the studio either, and lost on penalties, it was all looking so rosy for the Toon.
Well, interestingly, when they played Tottenham, they reverted, the formation reverted to the one that was common under Rafa Benitez. Oh. And before that, they'd been trying to play a two-pronged attack, mm-hmm. which hadn't worked, and it allowed Almirón, who was very, very quick, to go to play wide, but he has more space, and a much better game. Mm-hmm. So really,
still hasn't scored, I think
Steve Bruce has learned. I mean, he's, the problem is bringing. I think we signed 5 players in the close season, and 4 of which had never even played in this country before. Never been to Newcastle, so they had. It's going to be a while before they sort of get used to our culture and the way we play and the way the Football League is, the Premier League is, and also there's a change of manager, and it looks like Steve Bruce has realised that he made a mistake in the formation. He's going to start playing the way Benitez did, because he's going to have to, because the quality of the team they've got isn't as.
You're not going to say it's Rafa's team. Come now. Come in.
I'm not saying it isn't Rafa's team, because they've signed 5 new players. But certainly, there's absolutely undeniable is that the formation they played against Tottenham Hotspur was the one that Rafa Benitez employed predominantly last season.
So let's move on to what I'm going to refer to in this new feature, Tales from Ian Lennox's Journalistic History. Okay? I'll get a snappier title, or maybe a jingle composed to get something sorted out in the near future. But something which really appealed to me in terms of the line that you were talking about, Facebook posts, etc. Chris Kamara, or as we'd like to refer to him, Chris Unbelievable Kamara.
Yeah, he's lovely.
Now, is it true, and I'm thinking about, thankfully we don't have any student journalists in the studio with us, they might be listening, of course, but in terms of Chris Unbelievable Kamara, is it true that he actually lay down in the press box and basically...
Oh, not him, no. My friend, a journalist, did.
Ah.
50, 60 years ago. He's a friend of mine, and he didn't like football very much, but in those days, he was a district reporter. He went out and did everything, you know.
Fine.
And he went to cover this match, and he was so bored, he lay down and thinking that if there was a goal scored, he would be able to hear that crowd.
Uh-huh.
And he would then be able to catch up with what happened. And unfortunately, there was no other people in the press box. And secondly, the team that scored was the away team, so there was a total silence when the goal happened, so he missed it.
So that's not Chris Kamara, not to be confused
with
Chris Kamara.
Oh, no, not Chris Kamara, no.
Who obviously missed a red card on Soccer Saturday, which was another line entirely, which is hence the reason. So, and do you want to name your friend, Ian, or is it
Chris? No. He was a far better journalist than I was, I can tell you. I'm serious, he really was. He was outstanding and a good reporter.
But don't be so bored when you're covering a sporting event that you lie down in the press box. It wouldn't have happened at the Test match, and it probably shouldn't have happened at a football game either. So there we go.
I've had tales from the press box. I mean, I've had... One chap, the editor of the local newspaper, had to cover the game because of staff shortages, and he turned to me and said, "Which are we?"
He was probably having an existential crisis here. You know,
he was.
He just wasn't quite sure, you know, why he was here, what the purpose of life
was. I was very honest.
That's very good. Ian, one thing we haven't been able to do for a wee while, I suppose we did it a fortnight ago, but it's called the classic line, let's play Ian Lennox a telephone tune down the line so he can actually comment on the whole delights of this. And this is Tessa's selection for this week. Tessa Snart, of course. Exactly. She's working so hard these days, but she still has a feature on the show, and sometimes she can even actually introduce it herself. But
she got her own radio show now. She's got
Sound and Country Vision, exactly.
Yes.
So it's very good. New recordings being produced in the very, very near future, specifically this Sunday. But this is a band called Thompson Square, and it's called Millionaires. Are you ready to listen to Tessa's top tune for this, the last week in August 2019, Ian Lennox?
Right.
Millionaires.
Cracks in the window, cracks in the window. Got no money in the bank, no gas in the tank, no jingle in my jank. Baby, don't you think that we could take our love and turn it into money? We'd be rolling in the dough, let me tell you, honey, we'd be millionaires. You know that we'd be millionaires. If I could borrow your kiss, baby, you would think you'd be falling from the sky. We can make it. Anything you please, honey, I'm just dreaming. But if we could take our love and turn it into money, we'd be rolling in the dough, let me tell you, honey, we'd be millionaires. You know that we'd be millionaires.
I'm so tempted to go, yee-haw, but I won't. But what did you make of that, Ian Lennox?
Well, I liked it, actually, but, you know, I didn't. I would be hesitant to say so because my respect for Tessa so much, because when she was being on your programme, I thought she was quite an outstanding student. I'm happy to say I actually did like it really, really, really. And I don't know, what sort of genre is that?
I have no idea music, whatsoever. Don't ask me. You're going to have to ask the young people, Ian. I just take the things on a weekly basis from Tessa, and I'll feature them on the Midweek Drive, and then if they're successful, we move on from there. And occasionally, I'll allow to press a button on Sound and Country Vision. That's all I do. That's basically.
So really, it's not much point. I just have an opinion about this. I know nothing about this. That's a good premise to start on, isn't it?
It's a way forward, and so we're still teasing her from last night, where in essence she said, tune in for the Midweek Drive, it's 6:15. There's an hour and a quarter of good quality stuff we do before 6:15. Tessa, what are you thinking? You know, please, you know. We're shedding blood here. Just so we have been for the last 54 minutes. It's coming up to 6 minutes to 9:00. Ian, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yes, I have, thank you.
This is good. Coming up next, Peter Lyons, employment liability lawyer from Slater and Gordon, who has actually come up with a study that suggests 25% of people have had to leave at least one job in the last 5 years because of pressure. And 25%, another 25% of UK workers' mental health is at breaking point. Okay.
Wow.
Breathe. So we'll talk about that with Peter Lyons, and we've got Conversations and the Art of a Good Conversation once again with former SAS, MI5 and MI6 hostage negotiator Colin McLachlan. He has ways of making us talk. I'd try and not use that during the interview, although I don't think I'll be able to hold myself back. We'll just see. That's to come on Siren's Midweek Drive Morning Edition here on Siren Radio. Ian, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link?
Yes, I have, thank you.
Will you be back again next week?
I do hope so.
Marvellous.
keep pushing it right into you. Now see, I got what I remember you. And I remember you told me.
Mark Ronson featuring Camila Cabello and Never Find You Again. Well, as I mentioned, immediately after the news, we'll be talking about this shocking study that suggests that a quarter of UK workers' mental health is at breaking point. Already online and set and ready to go, we've got the awesomely talented employment liability lawyer from Slater & Gordon, the wonderful Peter Lyons. How are you, Peter?
Oh, good morning. Thank you. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. We'll talk a little bit about the findings of this particular study, which, as I say, is quite shocking.
Immediately
after the news from the Sky News Centre.
This is Siren Radio.
And the weather today, highs of 21 degrees centigrade, lows of 13 degrees centigrade. It's going to be a fresh, breezy day in Lincoln with sunny intervals. So good news from that front, at least. Now, moving on to this little item about UK workers' mental health being at breaking point. As we mentioned, a quarter of people have had to leave at least one job in the last 5 years because of pressure and the negative impact it was having on their mental health. Peter Lyons, as employment liability lawyer, is this something which you're surprised at? Is it a case of, well, we look at the state of play? We just heard the 2 minutes of almost unremitting doom and gloom from the news there in terms of headlines and so on. And we're in this situation where people are even lying about taking mental health days. They're effectively saying you're making up disease problems, physical illnesses, etc., because actually, you know, they just can't cope.
Yes, it's sad, but that's the situation, because people should not feel that they've got to lie about their mental health. But the reality is that people feel that they will be discriminated against if they tell the truth about the mental health problems that they are having. Many people don't want to disclose their need to take a mental health day. That is a day off work, suffering from stress, anxiety, depression or other mental health reasons, because they don't want to confront the stigma that they may face around the topic. Also, some people feel that sick days are reserved purely for physical illness, but a mental injury is just as valid as having the flu or another injury.
Now, I was intrigued to find that even in the 21st century, we get the response that workers will say, man up, you know, braveheart, all the rest of the bits and pieces. I mean, that's probably the worst thing you can actually do in terms of an inappropriate reaction to a worker that you know, experience. And, I mean, from the gender sort of split, is there any kind of noticeable difference between male and female in this? Or is it just a case of, well, men traditionally have to hide their feelings more?
I don't think there's a gender. I'm not aware of there being any gender split. Mental health problems affect so many people across all genders. Interestingly, 14% of people surveyed were told at some point that they had to man up and deal with it. And personally, I just find that absolutely appalling. It demonstrates a lack of training and awareness amongst the managers in charge of staff. And in some cases that I am currently dealing with, we have companies who have the perfect policies and procedures in place, but they're not followed. And the end result is that there'll be workers who perhaps may have some underlying vulnerability, but in any event, their mental health is being affected.
Is there a protocol that is actually in place in terms of if people in a workplace feel that they're being met with challenges that really they shouldn't be met with when it comes to their mental health issues and so on?
I don't think there's a specific protocol in place, but what people should do is not be isolated. They should tell the people that they're closest to about the problems that they are having. They should keep a record as to what's causing the stress and anxiety. If necessary, they should get medical help, see their GP. But that, of course, wouldn't tackle the underlying problem, which is the problems at work. And so if they're comfortable in doing so, then they should report the problems to the manager. But, of course, many people are not comfortable doing that because they feel that it will be held against them, or they may not have a close enough relationship with a manager to be able to explain that they are having mental health problems. In those circumstances, they should either speak to a trade union representative or somebody that they are close to at work. And ultimately, if they require legal redress or legal advice, then they should seek that either from Citizens Advice Bureau or a solicitor specialising in the area.
You've raised a number of very key and important points there, Peter, and one trusts that actually folk who are faced with this situation will be able to take those steps. But it's often said, and understandably, that if you're actually under a lot of mental stress, maybe your thinking procedures aren't at the best of functioning at the time, really. So you probably also need, as we mentioned with respect to stress, some suitable advocacy. And is this something where traditionally trades unions would have actually provided support, etc., and maybe we need that kind of additional presence within the workplace to actually prevent this kind of notion of burnout and stress and so on?
Yes. I've acted in the past for many clients who have been trade union members, and the role of the trade union has been invaluable. Some trade union representatives have offered very, very good support for some of my clients and their families, because the mental health problems doesn't just affect the individual with the medical condition, but it affects their families as well.
And presumably also the fellow workforce as well, because if you have a situation where people are your colleagues and they're under stress, under pressure, etc., they're not performing at any kind of optimum level, that is obviously going to have knock-on effects throughout the company and the situation as well. And before
Absolutely.
You know where you are, you have all sorts of other challenges. Where would you suggest people should actually go to if they've been listening to this, Peter, and they really need to actually have some further information? Because literally within 7 or 8 minutes, we can only cover the tip of the iceberg, sadly, with respect to this. So where would you point them?
Mental health charities. There's some a lot of advice available online. Trade union representatives, and websites of law firms.
Yeah, and as I say, just the shocking news in the East Midlands, obviously Lincoln's actually based from that point of view, 57% of East Midlands employees think their working environment has a negative impact on their mental health. Two-thirds say they're suffering with or have suffered with anxiety, stress or burnout in the workplace. And on average, employees in the East Midlands have taken almost 5 days off work in the last year due to mental health problems. That is not a good sign, given the sort of current political situation where we're being encouraged to actually work harder, work faster, work stronger and so on. But that's another issue, perhaps. Peter, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self. Hopefully it hasn't been too stressful for your good self.
Not at all, and thank you for having me on.
Well, we certainly look forward to featuring you again in the very near future, and keeping us appraised of, obviously, hopefully, signs of improvement in the case of the UK workforce and their state of mental health. Many thanks.
Fingers crossed. Thank you.
Moving straight ahead.
my word, it's almost as though we're back in the 1980s. John Parr and St. Elmo's Fire launched the Brat Pack. Coming up in a few moments' time, we will be talking to not only Angela Lewis, a wine expert from Villa Maria, but also former SAS soldier and hostage negotiator Colin McLachlan about, well, the art of a good conversation. Well, maybe talking, maybe actually not talking. We're still actually trying to get through to our hostage negotiator. Maybe he's actually in negotiations, who knows. Reminder, of course, later on this evening on Siren Radio, we've also got another classic Stone Tapes, Volume 51 of the premier genre-based show with Sam Stone, hence the Stone Tapes, David J. Howe, and a whole heap of other co-hosting goodiness. And we're motoring on in terms of the wonderful joys of Siren Radio, because time being ever at the sort of essence of all sorts of things, as promised, we finally managed to get through with the correct numbers and so on to our communications delightful folk. First of all, former SAS MI5 and MI6 hostage negotiator, Colin McLachlan. How are you, Colin?
Yeah, very well this morning, thank you.
Excellent, and we've also got the wonderful soul who can clearly actually have all sorts of wonderful things when it comes to good conversation. That's the wonderful Angela Lewis. How are you, Angela?
I'm great, thank you.
Marvellous. Colin, clearly, when we start talking about holding a conversation, it seems as though we're not really good at it in Britain. We have sort of challenges which, you know, we shouldn't talk about politics, obviously, shouldn't talk about religion, step aside from that, and our attention spans seem to be sort of dropping the more chronologically gifted we get. 4 minutes is the maximum thing. So is it a case of, as a nation, we're just not listening?
No, I think most Brits would take stock with that, because if I think about myself, I've got two neighbours either side of me in their 70s, and they could keep me for half an hour from getting to the shops or getting out there talking about, you know, what Missy Smith is doing at 26 and what I'm doing with the back garden and stuff like that. So no, I'm not sure about that. I think as Brits we're quite well known for our conversation and a nice drink. So yeah, I'm not sure about that one.
Oh, we combined talk with red wine in terms of our lead up to this. Angela, as a wine expert with Maria, who obviously responsible for this survey, were you surprised by the key things that were there? Was it something which you thought, I don't know, maybe we are actually just too busy to actually speak to people?
I think perhaps we have got busy, and I think one of the statistics was 59% of Brits actually do most of their conversations through technology, so texting and emails, etc. So I think we still save ourselves for the people we really want to talk to. That how we have our social times, and that's those times when you sit down with a glass of wine and really enjoy the mood and in a group situation. But I think there has been a lot of the small bits and pieces have been taken up with texting, and I know personally I do that myself. And to see that, you know, how about nearly 6 million people spend more than 4 hours a day on their phones, and I think it's pretty obvious that's going on. You just need to see people when they're walking around. So I think we've become more selective possibly with our chat.
Colin, are there skill sets that you've picked up in terms of obviously hostage negotiation and so on that actually can apply to this state of mind when it comes to how we can relate to people? Is it a case of you build a commonality, you look for mutual interests, you look for happy stories, you look for nostalgia? Is that the kind of key things that will bring us success when it comes to conversation?
Absolutely. I'm not sure it's a black art in terms of, picking subjects and all sorts of stuff. I think some of them apply throughout life, so whether that's body language, eye contact, picking subjects that, you know, are social, mutual interest stuff, you know, keeping away from politics or religion unless the person's specifically interested in that, then I think those things can all be taken into normal everyday life, and I certainly do that. Another good technique is humour. I think we're well known, you know, for that that humour, and certainly I do a lot of public speaking. One of the things I do early on is I tell a funny story or I crack a joke, and then everybody relaxes right away. And I think doing something like that, breaking the ice, like having a fine wine, is key to that.
Now, Angela, clearly there are teetotalers who say you can't have a fine wine, but, you know, let's step aside from that particular concern at this particular moment. Would you say that actually having a nice rosé, etc., can actually just, as it says, break the ice, or is it a case of no, we need to work beyond that?
No, I think it does. I think wine's so interesting. It can come from all over the world. It's such an interesting thing to talk about because of the flavours, etc., and how it's made. You know, red wine has been, you know, goes into oak barrels, etc. So you can actually have a conversation about the wine. And I think the moment when you say rosé, we're drinking the most incredible amount of rosé. It's the biggest growing category, and people are loving it. And it seems to be getting paler and paler, and it's getting drier, and it's the perfect when we've had this heat wave, we've wave we've just had. It's a perfect thing to sit down and chat about. One of our experts, Judy James, we compared it to coffee. And you can talk about coffee for a while, but wine you can talk about for much longer. So it can be a mutual conversation and everybody can have their say.
Colin, in terms of your hostage negotiations, do you ever have a temptation to actually say, look, let's just break out the glasses and let's have a nice little sip?
That would be nice. I'm not sure alcohol would always lend itself to that particular area of the Middle East. But what I would say is, I think whenever you've had conversation and you break out a nice wine, it allows conversation to naturally flow. You think about wine, and you know, you take time to you know, savor it. And there's those key silences in between. And silence is actually a useful tool in hostage negotiation. I think there was quite an interesting stat out on the Villa Maria website that talked about one of the biggest fears people have is these awkward silences and stuff, when actually that's a very useful tool in hostage negotiating. It allows the other party to either contemplate, think, have a rational opinion, or even start the talking themselves.
See, I'm already beginning to think that actually, as far as the current government are concerned, they should actually scrap all the particular sort of folk in charge of negotiations with Europe and actually just put yourself and Angela in charge, Colin. I think that would be a way forward in terms of addressing this. Maybe you might not want the job, I don't know. But Colin, are there any top tips you could actually suggest would be useful to take away from today in terms of how we can actually engage in mutually successful conversation and something where you feel, connected to another human being?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of great tips under statistics on the villamaria.com website, but I think for me personally, I think taking the time, not being afraid of the silence, to sit and think about what it is that you want to talk about and have a rational opinion on something and just find common ground, because we all have common ground with everybody. And certainly wine's one of those areas where, you know, a lot of us have common ground.
And you know, given that recent surveys suggest that certainly when it comes to Generation Z or the millennials and so on, they might have lots and lots and lots of friends on the social media, etc. But in terms of real acquaintances and real people to actually consider, we're getting down to really single figures. Is this a chance, Angela, where you can actually make those contacts? As we say, it's part of being human, maybe connecting to another human being through a conversation.
Absolutely. Part of this campaign, we went into big, large public workspaces, and the feedback we got was incredible. People were meeting each other often for the first time because we created an environment where they were tasting our wine. So, you know, that in itself was actually fantastic, and we did those all over the country. So they got the opportunity to come down and share a wine, and they had a little card, so they'd start talking about which wines they preferred, etc. So it was actually fantastic to watch.
villamariawines.com/value of conversation, presumably the best place to go to for further information.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, it's been a joy and a delight connecting with both your good self, Colin McLachlan, and Angela Lewis this morning. Has it been okay for you folk? Have you enjoyed it as well? The conversation, the chat, the interview. Has it been good?
It has been good, yes. Very good.
Yeah, I don't. Sometimes you think it's going so well and then, whoa, what happens? I take it then you'll be able to return in the not-too-distant future. Will you come back and join with us again in the near future and have a little chinwag about life?
Absolutely. Love to.
Definitely.
I'm hearing the light from the window. I'm seeing the sound of the sea. My feet have come loose from their moorings. I'm feeling quite wonderfully free. And I think I will travel to Rio, using the music for flight. There's nothing I know of in Rio, but it's something to do with the night. It's only a whimsical notion to fly down to Rio tonight, but I probably won't fly down to Rio. But then again, I just.
behind fancy. There's wings to the thought behind the play, and dancing to rhythms of laughter makes laughter the rhythm of rain. So I think I will travel to Rio, using the music for flight. There's nothing I know of in Rio, but it's something to do with the night. It's only a whimsical notion to fly down to Rio tonight. And I probably won't fly down to Rio, but then again, I just might.
And it may well be that you want to travel down to Rio for your final days, or maybe not. Maybe you just want to actually go up in terms of a rocket ship, and maybe you want to be scattered at sea. Who knows? But the key thing when it comes to modern-day family trees and so on, recently suggests that over 500,000 funerals have kind of demonstrated they're becoming more personalised, friendly to the environment. We've shed the traditions we've been used to for centuries and so on. In fact, now 1 in 10 people would want a religious ceremony for their final farewell. Who better then to speak to about this particular fact than someone who genuinely deserves the sobriquet National Treasure? He is, of course, the awesomely talented, tremendously it's wonderful. So, who is Ricky Tomlinson? How are you, Ricky?
I'm on top of the world, sir. Thank you.
That's what we like to hear. Now, this particular element that's come across here, funerals back in the Victorian days, of course, the funeral procession, the Gothic march, etc., was a whole event, a grand routine. And then we went through a phase of we can't talk about the D word, we can't work on that basis, we can't speak about funerals and so on. And now we actually have a sixth of people surveyed have actually been asked to arrange a superhero-themed funeral. What's happening with the world, Ricky? Or is it just a case of, well, you know, we need to actually sort of ensure that choice will continue to evolve and so on?
I just think people have got tastes changed, don't they, over the years? Tastes change, and although some of these things are really, really interesting, you know, but I still would like a church service when I snuff it.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you there, Ricky. I mean, maybe it's my Catholic upbringing and so on, but I don't think, yeah, let's go with that, you know?
But you know, you're talking about it. I've just been to two funerals recently, and to two real well-known people. One was Ken Dodd, Sir Ken Dodd, and his funeral was amazing. And it was at the Anglican Cathedral in Liverpool. There was thousands of people there, and they cheered the coffin, and the service was great, and it was fabulous, like. And then recently I went to Joe Longthorne's. And Joe Longthorne, as you know, was a traveller, and he was a Catholic. Mm. And they had this in a fabulous church. And his eulogies, he had four speakers, and they were all comedians. It was Chubby Brown, Johnny Casson, Roy Walker, and his MD, a fella called Muddy. And it was hilarious. The service was really nice. It was beautiful. It was everything it should have been. And then they had this wonderful outburst of happy memories and laughing, and there was two tremendous funerals, totally different, but both tremendous. So it's you know, you pay your money and you take your choice.
Interesting to find that back in the day, of course, having your ashes scattered across Goodison Park or Anfield, etc., that was, I think, something that was put forward. I'm not sure, well, in these days of high-dealing premierships, etc., you wouldn't actually want to go there. And there is an obvious joke here coming together with Bury, but I won't mention that for obvious reasons because it would be in poor taste. But, I mean, from the way in which tastes are actually changing, were you surprised by any of the suggestions? I mean, being sent up as a firework and or turned into a piece of jewellery, I thought quite amazing in terms of how people would actually have their final farewell. It makes that, you know, ashes in an urn quite mild by comparison.
Well, it is. I wouldn't fancy getting turned into a piece of jewellery. I mean, blinking neck. I don't mind being a tree. I think that's great. You know, getting my ashes and mixing it in with a bit of compost and have this great big weeping willow. It'd have to be a weeping willow because Rita said I never stopped moaning. And but that'd be quite nice, wouldn't it? Just think of the, amount of ground we'd save instead of burying people in them, plots and stuff like that. We could build a few houses on them.
It's a thought. It's a radical thought, Ricky, but it's a thought to actually work through from that point of view. And you know, you mentioned obviously one of the great, I mean, two of the greats actually. I mean, we worked obviously with Doddy. I mean, in essence, you had to hand over the whole show to Ken basically because he would just keep going, you know, forever.
He would, yeah,
from that point of view. In terms of that, looking, I don't know, 2050, 2060, so a good 20 or 30 years from now, what would your own sort of desires and thoughts be?
I don't know. You know, they say what you want in your coffin. Some people have a Chinese takeaway, others have a rocking. That they said, what would you like in your coffin? I said, somebody else. If you could arrange that,
if we go back in time to the Egyptian pharaohs and so on, they used to have all their servants and everybody sort of buried with them. So I mean, that's the whole essence of the pyramid, really. Bit harsh, yeah. I would have thought, but you know, it did happen.
Yeah, but I was in Egypt once. I went to that tomb and. But it just, there was a notice outside that only Tutankhamun. So I don't know whether that means anything.
Yeah, you're just rolling them out there, aren't you? Extraneous.
Now listen to me. Listen, I'm 80 years of age in a couple of days. And years ago, when people got buried, we left it all to the undertakers. Mm. Now, where I lived in the very, very working class part of Liverpool, we used to just call a co-op in, and they buried me mum and me dad, and the services were great. They had this guy called Colin. And he came in the thing with the top hat and the walking cane and walked in front of the hearse. And he'd done an amazing job. And that was tremendous. And so this is all brand new to me about this going up in rocket ships and turning into a stone or a tree. But, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm broad-minded and I'll have a little look at what's going on. But for me, I would like a little church service before I finally... Finally go.
Well, I suppose this might be the century in which we'll have the first people buried on the moon or maybe even Mars. You know, it's
absolutely, yeah.
Still, life continues. Now, where, Ricky, would you point people to find out more details about funeral? Would you say go to the cut? Where's the cut of key place? You actually say, you know, it's all very well talking about this and so on and so forth. We might have many people actually hammering on their undertakers' doors, quite literally saying, I want what Ricky Tomlinson wants, or not, as the case may be.
It's coop.co.uk/funeral trends, and you go on there, and you'll get all sorts of information. You know, I mean, God, obviously, people don't think about this till the very last minute, but it's now that I'm more aware of it. Now I'll start making arrangements now for myself, and you know, and
another 30 years, Ricky. I think that's
I hope so. Yeah. I'll settle for that.
I mean, we need to have a successor to Ken Dodd on these Siren Radio shows. I mean, you've already proven you've got the scouse wit in terms of the joke telling routine. So we'll work on that basis. You know,
Doddy was wonderful. He was a one off, and as I say, his funeral and Joe Longthorne's totally different, but totally wonderful. Both experiences I'll never forget. Both out with dignity, but laughter, and it was. Wonderful. I just wish all funerals were like that, you know? Everyone deserves that, don't they? A wonderful, decent, nice send-off, but at the same time, a bit of happiness and a bit of mirth, you know?
Precisely. And indeed, you can be eco-friendly with coffins that use products like bamboo, banana leaves, and indeed biodegradable wool. It's amazing stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
It's just a win-win situation, certainly. Ricky, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self. We've got two final questions. They're not too difficult, hopefully. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Have we had what?
A reasonable chat with us today. Has it been okay for you, sir?
Been fabulous, young man. Fabulous.
Well, in which case, can we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you connect with us in the not-too-distant future?
I'd love to. I would love to, young man.
Hurrah!
Turn there.
Sutherland Brothers and Quiver, Arms of Mary. It's coming around to 90 minutes to 10 a.m. here on Siren Radio. Midweek Drive Morning Edition continues with one more interview to be squeezed into the programme today, and that's with Ace TV presenter and mother of two, Angelica Bell. Yeah, in a week's time, it'll be back to school. The new term is all geared up for all sorts of other areas, and 45% of parents have been experiencing nervousness or anxiety on their children's first day at school. We'll find out what Angelica's tips are and thoughts as far as that's concerned after something which kind of is fairly self-evident. I don't know, it's one of those great unanswered questions, really. How can you have any pudding if you don't eat your meat? Not good for vegans, though. And looking at some of the factors in the East Midlands, 45% of parents are experiencing nervousness or anxiety on their children's first day of school. 47%, so again, a little under half, will miss having their child at home during the day. 44% of parents see bedtimes and early start times as a family challenge during back-to-school period. And 39% of parents see new morning routines also as a challenge. So again, to hopefully look at how these challenges can actually be addressed and so on. Hopefully in a few seconds time, assuming she's actually not too late, we'll be speaking to the aforementioned TV presenter, Angelica Bell. Oh, yeah, yeah. I suppose it's all down to motivation. Bustard, what I go to school for, maybe for the slightly older pupils from that point of view, as opposed to the little ones. And as we promised a wee while ago, we're delighted to welcome, to provide our own insight and sage wisdom in terms of getting ready for school and coping with those school gate fears, the awesomely talented Renaissance woman when it comes to TV presenters. It's Angelica Bell. How are you, Angelica?
Very well. Thank you so much for that intro. I've never been introduced like that before. Someone's having wisdom. I'm going to tell my husband.
Yes, exactly. It's true. Now, some of the top tips from Tiny Pop, who are obviously responsible with respect to this, that first day scenario, I mean, we're literally probably 168 hours away, less now. You know, probably the hours are sort of counting down until the school starts again, and that first experience of a new school uniform, name tags sewn on, shoes lined up and so on, is going to be happening. Can be quite stressful, I would have thought.
Oh, it is stressful. I've been there twice. And I've been working with Tiny Pop because they've done some research which said almost half parents admit to getting nervous about their little children starting school, which is not a surprise. It's a new chapter, new challenges. And, you know, mums and dads are apprehensive because they don't know what to expect, and also they don't know how their child is going to react to it. So it's that week where sort of like temperatures and tensions are rising because for that big day, that first day of school.
It's also an interesting example of time, because we were talking to a few youngsters in the studios yesterday who were saying that they wanted a time machine that could actually make the holidays last longer and the school period last a lot shorter, basically. It's kind of like relativity from that, basically. Because it does seem as though, you know, the school holidays are like, whoosh, over like that, and suddenly you're starting up with this huge, brave new world of school gates and so on.
Yeah, it's a massive change. And so I'm not surprised they want that time machine. If they get that time machine working, maybe we could all get it. Actually, we might want to go back in time.
Well, let's move on from sort of some practical routines. If you haven't got access to a time machine, that maybe you can actually apply these 10 top tips from Tiny Pop from that point of view. Number one, of course, being don't wait until the first day.
No, I think that's a really important tip, because what I learned is if you're prepared, you shall not fear. You know that saying? And I think getting the uniform in advance, talking to your child about, you know, what lies ahead and asking them how they feel, I think that's really important. And then you can get your anxieties and fears out as well if you discuss it together. But have things sorted night before, snack boxes. Sometimes what I do as well to help, which I learned, I mean, I didn't do this at first because sometimes I'd forget things, is have things by the door ready, you know, so the night before we'll prepare. And if you do have any concerns about your child, make sure you tell the school in advance, and it's not on the first day of term.
Yes, teachers are suffering from stress as well. Many's the sort of head teacher who's actually said, I don't want to go back to school. But anyway, two and three, be prepared to help your child be prepared. We've covered that. Making sure that everything has a place is important, I would have thought.
So I had this thing where you'd be asking where socks were, where shoes were, where to pee kit, rushing around the house in the morning, and it's horrible and it's so stressful. So now I just know where everything is. You know, tell them where to put their bags, or I put the bags up, put the lunchbox in certain places, put the uniform, fold it in one place, and then you know where to go. And if everyone in the house knows that, it really does make a difference.
So I can see also, Angelica, actually applying this almost rehearsal-based system, which you have several rehearsals, until within the Bell household it's like a crack team as you head off to school from that basis. You know, a routine run-through advance would be like, you know, the International Rescue Boys and Thunderbirds all set and ready to actually go. We're off. We're sorting out on that basis. Lunch is an important one, of course. Making sure that you know what your children are eating, whether it's a school dinner or packed lunch, that's fairly critical, I would have thought.
Oh, definitely. You know, most schools have a system so you can find out in advance if they're going to eat, you know, school dinners or if you're going to get packed lunch. But if you are going to get packed lunch, make sure, there were so many times where, even with snacks, I'll be running to the shop at like 10 o'clock at night to make sure everything's sorted for the next day. So just be, again, just think ahead. That will really help in the morning, especially if you've got to get ready for work as well. You don't want to be running around in the morning, or get even like basics for milk. You know, we're saying about routines, maybe do a trial routine to make sure you know what you need. Sit them down, if you need to, sit them down in front of the telly. Again, on Tiny Pop website, there's all these tips and programs that you can put them in front of. Sit them down, and then do you have your shower, get the breakfast ready, get them dressed as a trial run. I know some people do that, just so that your children know what to expect on the first day of school, so it's not, you know, comes out of the blue.
Indeed, and it's worthwhile noting as well that Tiny Pop is not referring to a teeny tiny bottle of lemonade or indeed a very small adult father from that point of view. It's actually a brand, so Tiny Pop as in pop music. Sorry, I just couldn't resist it. Moving on to something which I particularly like, the eighth recommendation here, talk about treats, that notion of actually having a goal, something to actually aim for and so on.
Yeah, that sometimes we would say, like, if you know, at the end of the week, we'll just nip to the corner shop, you know, buy something. You can have or spend something in your spend the money in your money box, to, and they look forward to it. Then they get through the week, they just think, yes, on Friday. It's like a carrot and stick, isn't it? We all need a little treat in our lives as well. So, you know, that's fun and makes the week go in a positive way for every child.
And maybe avoiding phrases like, well, it's the best years of your life. No, after this, it's all downhill. Not necessarily the best way forward.
Yeah, not say that.
No, yes. Things to possibly avoid. But be proud of the whole experience will be important, I would have thought.
Yeah, no, exactly. Nobody knows. No one's got a textbook on how to be a child or how to be a parent. You just got to go with it and do what's right for your family. But at the end of the day, it is a change. And, you know, I did shed a tear on the first days of school. When I had to take my little ones, because they'd been my friends for a long time. We'd hung out, we'd done cool things, gone to the farm, had a nap together, and just simple things like that, and all of a sudden it changes, and you have to entrust your those little people that you love with teachers, but you all work through it, and it gets done, and it's a new change, new aspect to life.
And maybe also flashbacks to your own period, because in terms of that whole notion that whatever your own experiences were as a child, inevitably we'll probably sort of put those to the fore as well. And you think, well, I might want to avoid that, basically.
Oh, yeah, totally. We can learn from how we felt or things that we might do differently. But those are pivotal times in our lives, isn't it? Once you started going to school and the world got bigger.
Well, I mean, this is one of the reasons why we're also going to award you the role of music producer for the next little track, Angelica. It's going to be an interesting one in terms of where you go, both from the Lego Movie franchise. We can have Everything Is Awesome or Everything's Not Awesome. You know, these are the key things. I mean, it could be a realistic one or one which actually sort of takes a completely rosy glow. Where would you suggest we should go?
Everything is awesome.
You're going to get everything. So never think about it. No, the Everything's Not Awesome didn't even cross the mind, basically. It wasn't even something.
I'm such a positive person. The glass is always half full.
This is excellent. In which case, two final questions. I think we'll get positive responses to. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning? Has it been good for you, Angelica?
It's been amazing.
And a reminder, people can actually go to the Tiny Pop website to find out further details of what we've been chatting about.
That's right.
And will you be kind enough to return in the not too distant future?
Yes, of course.
Yay!
I wake up in the morning, wide awake for the day. And I say, what a morning, it's all okay. It's all real, and that's why I feel. Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of a team. Good now.
Thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Colin McLachlan, Angela Lewis, Peter Lyons, Simon Hooper, Ricky Tomlinson and Angelica Bell. And thank you, dear listener, for however long you've been part of the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. It has been awesome. We'll be back with the Midweek Drive next Wednesday to actually explore a whole range of other exciting things as well. As next week, of course, on the Thursday, where we'll have other goodies in this particular slot for the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. That's it. Happy Thursday. Don't forget, we've got the Stone Tapes on at 7 o'clock tonight. And lots of great stuff as far as Siren Radio is actually concerned to help us through the day. It's Post Malone featuring Young Thug with Goodbyes to take us out. So, happy Thursday. She needs something to change. Need to take out the ass. So, get all tonight. And don't tell me to shut up. When you know you talk too much.